The Irish Times Business Podcast in association with Irish Life.
We can help your company and your employees look forward to tomorrow. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. Don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcast. Now, this week we're discussing the business of sport, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host, Michael O'Keefe, Chief Executive of Teneo PSG. Welcome back, Michael.
Hi, Ciarán. How are you?
Now, we're going to start with GAA, and the Congress recently decided to ban gambling sponsorship of any competition team, playing gear or facility. This is quite innovative by the GAA.
Yeah, very, very much so, and brave as well. I suppose you put this in context to sponsorship over the last 30 years, where tobacco was the first vice, I suppose, to be hammered.
Alcohol then.
Alcohol is now very much in the eye line of the legislators in this country, and has been in Europe. High fat, salt, sugar products as well are coming under the microscope in terms of particularly under 16 sports. And we would have always felt in the sponsorship industry that bookmakers would have been, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years away from people looking at them. But the GAA have got out of the block early, and I think they've been very vocal on
why.
I think a lot has been done. There's the GAA have people, full-time people in place like Colin O'Regan, and the GPA have been very vocal on this issue. There's been a lot of addiction cases like Niall McNamee, Oisin McConnell have been very vocal on it. You know, you could argue it has no impact on the GAA itself in terms of its own revenue, in that the GAA doesn't have a bookmaking partner. So it's more a symbolic gesture, I think, than anything else.
What about some of the clubs? Maybe some of the clubs around the country might have.
I think you're right. I think there's currently no bookmaker sponsoring an inter-county team, although Boyle Sports did sponsor Louth a number of years ago, and Ladbrokes sponsored Derry. I think at club level, I think, is where there might be issues, where the local bookmaker might just be just local businessman done good and is giving money to the local team. And, you know, there mightn't be any ulterior motive to it.
It also raises the issue as to where gambling begins and ends, because most clubs would have lottos, wouldn't they? They would have some sort of prize draws where they're encouraging people to spend a few bob and enter a competition to win and maybe pick numbers in receipt of national lottery funding.
Every club, soccer, rugby, GAA and others have lottos and so forth. I think that's, you know, on a personal perspective, I think it's probably a more benign thing, and it's a fundraiser. Last man standing in soccer, like, it's what's gambling, what's not. I think, you know, from a GAA perspective, I think it was a symbolic thing. I think it was a very interesting thing that they did. I think what it does is it opens up the conversation that probably hadn't been had before. We've three League of Ireland teams that are sponsored by bookmakers. You have big sports organisations here which have official bookmaking partners. I think the UK is the big one. 9 out of the 20 Premier League clubs have bookmakers on the front of their jerseys.
Yeah, we had a case last season, didn't we, in the League of Ireland involving Athlone Town and Longford, I think it was,
absolutely,
if memory serves me, where there was suspicious betting activity from Asia and elsewhere. Anyway, we'll move on because it's Six Nations weekend. The Scots are coming to town. Ireland are on the march towards the Grand Slam. I'm sure you'll be at the game, Mick. And these matches are worth a lot to the local economy, aren't they? This is the third home Six Nations game of the season. First, happens every 2 years that we have three home games. And the IRFU estimating that the economic impact is somewhere between 60 and 80 million euro. Now, I have to tell you, I'm always a little sceptical about these economic impact statements around sports events and festivals.
And rightfully so, because it's quite complex when you start to actually get into it, because, you know, you look at Dublin on a Saturday night where you might have 90% hotel occupancy anyway, so you have to calculate based on the extra bounce that they get and the extra cost of the hotel rooms. Pubs are usually full in Dublin on a Saturday night anyway, so, and then obviously the times of the game has changed, so if it's a 2 o'clock game, how does that impact the pubs versus a 5 o'clock game versus a 7 o'clock game? So there isn't an exact science. Smurfit have done some work on this. Some of the IRFU themselves have done some work. Dublin Chamber of Commerce have done some work. The IRFU will be saying on the weekend, I understand from talking to them, that 25 million is as accurate an estimate as they can make, which is a calculation based on ticket prices, hospitality, and then from the information they get from pubs. The LVA would say that somewhere between 25 and 30% uplift for things like All-Ireland football finals. The Vintners, would claim. And things like hotel rooms is probably a little bit more nuanced, because, again, you know, with such high occupancy rates, the hotels might be full anyhow, so you can't necessarily put it all down to the rugby. But it tends to be a huge social occasion, and somewhere around the 25 million is the number that's been bandied around. But again, Sunday game's different to a Saturday game, and so forth.
Okay, are we going to win?
Hope so. Hope so.
Okay, let's talk about stadium naming rights. And that game between Ireland and Scotland will be taking place in the Aviva Stadium, named after the insurance company. They recently renewed their deal. We've had some research from Duff and Phelps in the UK suggesting that naming rights probably still some way to go. I think they were suggesting that Manchester United could really cash in if they were to seek a sponsor for Old Trafford. But they also highlighted the fact that in Ireland it really is an unexplored, largely unexplored market.
Yeah, and look, you know, this organisation did this research obviously from a publicity perspective for themselves, but quite interesting, they put a perceived value on what they thought each stadium would be worth, and Old Trafford was number one. We've had Pádraig Duffy in here and he's said absolutely no way would they sell the name rights to Croke Park. It is becoming interesting, I think, where it becomes...
But other GAA grounds have sold their naming rights.
They have, and the GAA one is interesting in that the theory of naming rights is that it tends to be simpler with a new build or a rebuild. So you have it here, the point was knocked down and rebuilt and it became the O2. You had Lansdowne Road was there and then it was knocked down and was rebuilt.
Should say the O2 is now the 3 arena.
It's now the 3, yeah.
No, just,
so it wasn't now, sorry, not now the O2. It became the O2 and then now is obviously the 3. And then same with Lansdowne was knocked and rebuilt and became the Aviva, the new theatre, which was Grand Canal Theatre. It was
And I think a lot of people were sceptical when Lansdowne Road was renamed the Aviva. They were sceptical that it would catch on, but I think it has.
Absolutely, and I think name adoption, I think people have been quite apt. But taking your point on the GA thing is very interesting, and I think a lot of the grounds are named after old Irish heroes and so forth. So
Patriots,
let's call them, yes. And what you'll often find is that the heritage of the name is so strong that they go with a double barrel name. So we have the Kingspan Breffni Parks and the Innovate Wexford Parks and the Netwatch, Dr. Cullens and so forth. So it's much more difficult from a GA perspective. And also you have this issue where people are using it, I think, sometimes to think get a quick buck. You know, if you're going to do naming rights, it needs to be kind of a 10-year thing. So what will be interesting is we've got Kingspan.
It's a forever thing when you think about it. I mean, certainly from the point of view of the owner of the stadium, they want it to be a forever thing because they want that income stream to continue.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what you don't want is the name constantly changing names. It has happened in the States where you've got names of stadiums and they're changing every 5 years. It's confusing.
It's happened in Britain too, I think, with some of the football. What about Thomond Park? Because Munster have been talking about this for years and yet it hasn't happened. Why not?
And Thomond is one where people have said never say, you know, that it won't happen. Obviously, money will obviously impact that decision. Would they go with a double-barreled name, or would they go with just one clean sweep, or will they name stands and so on? I don't know. That's one that's going to be open for.
Okay, all right.
Or the S is one that's obviously...
Are the ones tipped to get that sponsor whenever the stadium gets rebuilt. Again, we seem to be talking about the redevelopment of the RDS for since God was a boy. But anyway, all right, we're going to stick with the sponsorship theme. And all 18 teams in the Bundesliga in Germany, that's the top tier of German league football, now have a sleeve sponsor. Are we going to see that in GAA or in League of Ireland, or what's going to happen?
Yeah, I suppose the point of this is that the Bundesliga, you know, they've been lauded recently for the way they run their leagues, and the teams are particularly well run, member-owned clubs and all that kind of stuff. And the top two divisions, every team had the same sleeve sponsor, which was a central contract, which is done by the Bundesliga itself. What they did is they took that back, and now the last team to get a sleeve sponsor has just got one. The question is, would organisations like the FAI with League of Ireland teams or the GA do a central deal that would maybe impact and every team would have the same sleeve sponsor as another stream of revenue? I think only time will tell.
Yeah, I just wonder whether you get bang for your buck out of sleeve sponsorship, because a lot of the League of Ireland clubs have sponsors on the back of jerseys, and oftentimes it's very hard to make out with the numbers and sometimes stripes and hoops and all sorts of things. It's often difficult to make out.
I agree with you, and I think you don't want a situation where it's like, you know, Formula One cars and there's, you know, there's logos all over the place, and I think it just becomes confusing. I think the front and back has worked well for the GAA at a time when that was introduced, was when counties were finding it difficult to get a sponsor to pay a premium for the front of jersey, and they kind of felt, okay, well, we might get two sponsors, front and back. And back has actually worked particularly well, especially in GA and the camera angles that go with that. The sleeve, I don't know, would there be an appetite for it, and I don't know whether it would be implemented and would it be impactful. It's very difficult to know.
I've always wondered about the helmets in hurling. Why aren't they sponsored?
You're not allowed actually have playing gear isn't allowed to be sponsored, which includes your boots and helmet and hurl.
Right, okay.
That's my understanding. If you remember, a certain company had hurls branded, and it was a footballer, Cork footballer, had Corona, I think, on his football boots. Paddy Power at the Hurls, if you remember as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, thanks for naming Paddy Power and giving me free publicity for that. But all right. And thank you also for clearing up that issue around hurling helmets and sponsorship. We'll leave it there. Thanks, Mick.
Cheers. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be looking forward to the Cheltenham Festival and speaking to its main organiser, Ian Renton. Back in a few moments.
Only 29% of us know how much we need to live on in retirement. Irish Life is changing that with Empower, a new approach to company pensions that helps change the way your employees think about their future. For more, go to irishlifeempower.ie or talk to your pension consultant. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. All information sourced for Irish Life, June 2015.
Now, welcome back. This is Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. Let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcasts. Now, the Cheltenham Racing Festival springs into action on Tuesday, continuing on until Friday, with about 250,000 people set to pass through the gates over the 4 days. There'll be plenty of Irish interest. Of course, some 10,000 punters are expected to attend from here, and there'll be a long list of Irish jockeys, trainers and horses all competing for glory. Ian Renton has been the man in charge of Cheltenham since 2012. During that time, he's overseen a £45 million redevelopment of the festival, including the building of a new grandstand, bars, weighing rooms and improvements to local infrastructure. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined on the line now from Cheltenham by Ian. And we're also joined in studio by my Irish Times colleague, Barry O'Halloran, who's an avid racing fan and an annual visitor to Cheltenham. And he'll give us the punter's view a little later on. But Ian, thank you for joining us. First of all, I should ask you about the weather. Obviously, some dreadful weather last week with the Beast from the East. How's that affecting your preparations for Cheltenham?
I mean, thankfully, the team here have done a brilliant job sort of leading up to that, in that the temporary facilities were ahead of schedule, and the team out on the course have done a brilliant job in having everything basically ready to go for before the Beast met Emma. We had an uncomfortable couple of days with snow, cold, and the wind sort of drifting the snow across everywhere. And in the end, I mean, the ground staff team, with a bit of sort of outside support, did a fantastic job in shifting, we think, somewhere between 250 and 400,000 tons of snow off the track.
Good grief. And Ian, maybe just set the scene for us. How big is the Cheltenham Festival, you know, in the context of the racing calendar? And give us some numbers behind it. You know, I mentioned 250 million people through the gate, but what kind of 250,000 people through the gate? I should correct myself there, yeah. How many, you know, what kind of revenues does it generate? How much do the bookies take in over that time? How many competitors are we talking about? How many trainers, horses, etc.?
Yeah, I in terms of that number of people, I mean, it's we expect between 250 and 260,000 people, which is the fourth highest sort of attendance of any sporting event in this country. So it's a big event, and we, on top of that, we've got high levels of hospitality. We entertain around 11,000 to 12,000 people every day taking hospitality from us, which makes it the biggest hospitality event in the country by probably quite a long way. So it's big business for the local economy. I mean, it's bringing in about over £100 million over the 4 days. So it's a big business for us and for the local economy.
Ian, hi, it's Mick O'Keefe here. How are you?
I'm well.
Just with respect to the Irish love affair with Cheltenham, which is obviously well publicised, we expect in the region something like 10,000 Irish to travel the week that's in it as well. And then, you know, over 20 million to be spent by Irish punters at the festival. How important is the Irish contingent to the festival? And do you expect that figure to increase? Obviously, things have picked up here. And did you see a decrease in the numbers post-2009?
Yeah, I only arrived here in late 2012, and at that stage we believe we'd had quite a significant drop off of the Irish invasion, so to speak. We've seen that increase over the last few years, and we now believe roughly 30% of, it's not necessarily 30% of the people, but 30% of the badges we sell, because many of the, or most of the Irish will stay for 2, 3, 4 days, probably more four than most. So we do have 30% of those sales is now sold to the Irish, so it's huge business here. Obviously the hotels, you go into most of the hotels, you struggle to find an Englishman in there. But we've also seen the sort of Irish hospitality market here pick up. Three, 4 years ago, there had been very few Irish booking hospitality here at the festival, and that's increased. So it's a massive part, and most of all, it's the horses that come over as well. I mean, we've had over 70 Irish winners in the 5 years I've been at the festival.
Ian, on with respect to hotels, which you've mentioned there, there's been a perceived issue about supply and mention of a hotel being built on site. Is that something that's in plans, and what impact might that have?
Yeah, we looked at it when I first came here. We sort of had a look at it, and I wasn't totally attracted to the idea as to, you know, whether the benefits outweigh any disadvantages in taking, you know, every bit of space here at the festival is very valuable. And I've just started looking at it again. I mean, I know the town here would love us to have a hotel on site. Even outside the festival, there's often a need for additional hotel rooms. And I think now it is something that could add to the whole experience if we were to find the right partner and build a hotel here. I think it'd be a nice option.
Ian, can I just ask you about targeting the Irish market? I mean, maybe you don't. I wonder how actively you target the Irish market. I mean, do you just, you know, expect punters to show up from Ireland because it is such a well-known festival and it's such a long tradition? Or do you actively market the festival in Ireland? And I'm just wondering in terms of sponsors too. I know you've got Ryanair and Ballymore on board as sponsors this year, but I'm just wondering in terms of maybe hospitality and sponsorship, how actively you target Ireland?
To be honest, probably not as actively as we should. I mean, when we did some research last year and found, you know, that the number of people coming to Ireland was, you know, on the steady increase, we felt that, you know, we don't put enough of our budget towards Ireland. We have targeted. I mean, occasionally we try to get an RTE. I think probably more on the PR side. Last year we came out, spent a bit of time in Dublin with the local media, and we spent quite a lot of time around the racing festivals to try and target the Irish market. But I think it's something we can do more of.
Yeah, is that something you're planning to do? Are you going to put a plan in place?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, every year we look at, you know, where our marketing is targeted, whether we got it right, and, you know, review it for the following year. So I'm certain it's an area we will consciously look at.
Yeah. And recently in Ireland, we've had the advent of the Dublin Racing Festival in Leopardstown. It's combined effectively 3 weeks of racing into one weekend. I'm just wondering if you think that'll become something of a curtain raiser for Cheltenham in the years ahead, and you think more UK-based trainers might decide to send some horses over?
Certainly it's a curtain raiser, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the most brilliant new initiative. I mean, because we failed to achieve something similar over here between Christmas and the festival. You know, I think we have, you know, some good races, but nothing that comes close to the Dublin Festival. And I think to have brought in that initiative to actually have what was, you know, great racing over the 2 days, and for me it's fantastic. I spent 2 days rather than my 1 day for the Irish Gold Cup, which is my usual visit. Was great to see the quality of racing and for people to see it. Yes, in many ways people were still seeing it as a trial for festival, but it was also a festival in its own right with horses targeting that, which might not be coming to the festival. So I think for us, you know, 5 weeks or so before the festival, to have such a great racing event was a massive benefit. With regard to the English runners, I mean, I think we regularly see through January, February, a reluctance from both Irish trainers and English trainers to cross the Irish Sea. I think in the past, Willie Mullins has been forced to do so because he's had such a sort of plethora of fantastic horses. He's had to try and split them up and has had no choice but to come over here. But generally, we don't tend to see the runners, particularly in the Grade 1 races, travelling across the Irish Sea much in January, February. I think it will increase. I think I'm sure some of the, you know, there are a lot of good 100,000 euro handicaps and things, which I think those will be targeted by English trainers, and I'm sure it will grow. But to be honest, I think it's a fantastic festival, even if it just had the handful of English runners that it had this year.
In big festivals like your own, have kind of booked the trend, I think, in terms of attendances at horse racing. Is there a time where you might get a little bit greedy and consider an extra day, or is four the optimum number of days? And obviously you've gone from three to four.
I personally think four is fantastic. I mean, it works. It is four brilliant days of racing. There's minimal dilution of what we've got. You know, people will say, you know, when you brought in the Ryan Air, you were sort of taking something away from the Queen Mother Champion Chase or the Timico Cheltenham Gold Cup. So I personally don't think that's the case. I think all three races stand up absolutely brilliantly. But the danger is, if you introduce more races, there will be some dilution effect. I think we've still got the numbers to fill on the first 3 days. I know we, for a number of years, have sold out on Gold Cup Day. But to me, I don't think there's a need to look that seriously at a fifth day until we can actually say we're full on 4 days.
Okay, fair enough. And just one thing that's happened here, Ian, in the last week is the GAA, which is the largest sporting organisation in the country, has banned gambling sponsorship, as they say, for any competition team, playing gear, etc., which was quite a bold first move by a sporting organisation here. If something similar was to happen in horse racing, you know, what kind of an impact would that have, do you think, on the industry, and what kind of an impact would it have in Cheltenham, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's much less likely ever to happen with racing, because the two, they are intrinsically linked, and I think we've got much better systems in place to ensure that, you know, betting on racing is safer than on any other sports. But we, over the last few years, have certainly sort of broadened our portfolio of sponsorship here to, you know, slightly reduce the emphasis on the betting companies. I mean, we now have sort of four financial companies involved. And, you know, when we brought in the new Gold Cup sponsor, Timico, from a technology area, we certainly look to try and maintain that breadth of sponsorship and partners here to, I think just from a brand presence, to be seen to encompass all areas of hospitality and sponsorship, not just the betting industry.
Ian, I might just bring my colleague Barry O'Halloran into the conversation at this point, because Barry has been a regular goer to Cheltenham now for a number of years. He's an avid race fan. Barry, what's your experience of Cheltenham every year? Why do you go?
Well, primarily you go because of the quality of the racing. There really isn't anything else where you get sort of the best of the best from both sides of the Irish Sea coming together, locking horns to do battle, and seeing who emerges the best. That's the central core of it. There is a lot sort of swirling around the festival now, and you see more and more swirling around it, if you like, every year. But at the centre of it is really is the standard of racing and the standard of horsemanship.
Now, you generally go for the 4 days. How many years in a row have you been at this stage?
Oh God, that's a good question, Ciarán. I'm not sure I liked you asking. I think this might be my 13th or 14th festival in a row.
Right, okay. And to a lot of people who aren't as interested in horse racing as you are, 4 days on the trot of non-stop horse racing, that seems like an awful lot. I mean, how do you put your days down?
How do I put my days down? Well, I go to the races, Ciarán. It does seem like an awful lot, but I think if you enjoy something, and if somebody is prepared to put on a spread of this quality, then I think it'd be really foolish not to take advantage of it and not to go along and enjoy every minute of it.
Yeah, good answer. How does Cheltenham compare with other festivals? I mean, let's say close to home, maybe Punchestown or even Leopardstown at Christmas.
Well, I have to say, and I'm a member of Punchestown and a very loyal race goer there. I think the Punchestown Festival, it also brings the best of the best together in many races, but the Punchestown Festival has a particular quality of its own and a particular uniqueness. I think it can hold its head up in alongside any similar event from anywhere in the world. The two festivals are slightly different. Punchestown has got a sort of a more intimate feel, a more local feel. Cheltenham seems to have a sort of a much bigger impact, I suppose.
Yeah, okay. And where do you stand on this whole issue of Mick Hastin, you know, whether they might look at expanding it beyond 4 days? Would you be in favour of that, or do you think 4 days is just about right?
Personally, I'd like 4 weeks, but I don't really see that being feasible. I mean, to me, I think 4 days is a kind of an optimum. I always felt that 3 wasn't quite enough, but I think 4 is an optimum. And given where it falls in the year and the timing kind of close to Patrick's Day, it sort of works really well from an Irish point of view as well.
Not directly linked to Barry, but just a question for you, Ian, on antisocial behaviour. And obviously last year, the drinking rules and times were changed to discourage this. Do you think this has had the desired effect?
We certainly felt it was effective last year, and I think it was a case of just trying to nip in the bud any issues that were occurring. I mean, I think we're very lucky here. I think of almost any major sporting event, we have a very good level of behaviour here. But, you know, and people want to come here, they want to have a drink and have a good time. That's what it's all about. But it was just trying to ensure that a very small minority of people coming here and wanting to have, you know, more than a drink and maybe, you know, step out of line in their behaviour, and we just want to nip that in the bud, and I think we successfully achieved that.
Yeah, and again, just relating to the experience as well, this delicate balance between, I suppose, embracing digital Wi-Fi facilities and, you know, all the bookies are operating online now, and how do you ensure, I suppose, that the experience and the on-track bookie tote experience remains relevant?
Yeah, I think that's it's a real tough one. I mean, particularly as we sort of bring, as we will be later this year, bringing the tote in-house, and, you know, we'll certainly want to be driving some custom of our race girls to the tote, and achieving that, yet knowing that the vast majority of our race girls will have their betting accounts, which we have facilitated in introducing Wi-Fi, and through the introduction of Wi-Fi, we've actually got much better mobile phone signal. 5 years ago, I mean, you know, you neither had Wi-Fi nor a mobile phone signal. So now that we certainly facilitated the ability to bet on course with their bookmakers. And I think, you know, it's not necessarily in our best interest, but I think it's in the race girls' best interest, and we got to look after them.
Ian, I should ask you about Brexit. It's a topic that dominates conversations, I think, on both sides of the Irish Sea, and the UK is due to leave the European Union next year. We don't know if there's going to be a transition deal or not, but how is that going to affect a festival like Cheltenham and National Hunt Racing?
Well, I think the biggest concern we all have, and it is particularly between the Irish and ourselves, is the transport of horses. And only last night I was talking to someone working within DEFRA to see, you know, how well we are progressing. And I think we, on this occasion, Britain is not probably the most popular member of the European Union at the moment, and therefore not necessary. Our requests are not necessarily being listened to in the way they should be. And we're probably going to want to work really closely with both the Irish and the French, in whose interests, as much as ours it is, to ensure that free movement of horses can continue post-Brexit, and to actually, we will be talking to the necessary ministers in both Ireland and France to try and persuade the European Union that it's not just in Britain's interest to maintain that, but, you know, it's absolutely essential for Ireland particularly.
Ian, just finally for me, just kind of one question in two parts, so it's technically two questions, but like, you've been attending Cheltenham for a long time yourself now. What is your outstanding Cheltenham memory is the first part of my question, and I suppose the second part is, in your position, your biggest challenge as you see it over the next 4 to 5 years?
I think I've had so many fantastic memories, but probably my one of my earliest would have been, I guess, I was going to say 1986, Dawn Run, getting up on the line to win the Gold Cup, which I just thought was one of those wonderful performances. And I think probably a few years later, you know, we had Desert Orchid, who was a horse I loved, in conditions he hated, everything against him other than that will to win at Cheltenham. And I think, you know, those in the 80s were my great memories of Cheltenham, but I have many more. Challenges the next 5 years. I think I've been incredibly lucky to sort of have had the honour of sort of overseeing Cheltenham for the last 5 years with the ability to invest £45 million into here, and to have seen, to been able to oversee the improvements that has brought about at the track is fantastic for me, both as a person in charge of Cheltenham, but also as a race goer of the past and the future. And I think having done that, still trying to make something better every year is an increasingly difficult challenge. But I think, you know, every single member of the team here, and I've got a fantastic team who do all the hard work here, we're all incredibly keen, and just each year looking back and thinking, yep, we've done things a little bit better than the previous year. And I think continuing to do that, as hopefully we can look back and think we've improved year on year, it probably gets harder every year.
Finally, Barry, it would be rude of us not to ask you for your outstanding memory. And then I've one final question for both yourself and Ian, but maybe you can give us your outstanding memory from Cheltenham over the years.
Okay, I'm going to go something slightly less mainstream or high profile, if you like, but it has to be Detroit City winning the Triumph Hurdle in 2006.
I knew you were going to say that.
for a lot of reasons, I think. I told everyone to back him in the weeks running up to the festival, and I knew I would be shot if he hadn't won when I got home. But he broke the track record that day, and he was a superb racehorse. And I think, Ian, you'll probably remember this. He won the Great Wood afterwards off Top Weight, which was a fabulous achievement for a four-year-old. He was ridden by the excellent Richard Johnson and trained by Philip Hobbs. Fabulous grey horse.
All right, and we'll close. It'd be rude for me not to ask you for some tips on the eve of this. I'm sure all of our listeners are hoping for some ideal tips for the festival. So, Barry, we'll start with you.
Okay, I'm going to go with the Tried and Trusted. I think Josie's Orders ranks a great each-way bet in the Cross Country Chase, which is the fifth race on the Wednesday. He's been there and done it, and he's trained by past master at winning these races, Enda Boulder, and he's owned by JP. And I'm going to stick with another Irish horse for my second tip. And I think that Sizing John is going to do a repeat in the Gold Cup. He won a really strong renewal of the race last year, beating a fair yardstick in Jack Adam. I know he had a glitch at Christmas, but the old saying, I think, always holds that you should always forgive a good horse a bad run. And he's in excellent hands with Jesse Harrington and Robbie Power. And I doubt very much that he's going to be out of the first three come Friday week.
Okay, Ian?
Well, funny enough, last year, the horse I was keenest on going into the meeting was Bouvardet. And I know he's going to be a short price this year, but I really struggle to see who's going to beat him this year. I think he won the Champion Hurdle one last year, won it well last year. It looks like at this stage we're going to be going into the meeting with ground certainly on the easier side of good, which is what we always like to start off on. He won't mind, whether it's good to soft, whatever. And I mean, he'd be my best tip for the meeting.
Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Michael O'Keefe, Ian Renton and Barry O'Halloran. Declan Conlon produced the show with JJ Vernon. As sound engineer, research was by Dan O'Neill of Teneo PSG. Don't forget you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on Twitter and Facebook each day. I'm Ciarán Hancock.
I'm Mick O'Keefe.
Until next time, take care.